This is the story of two young American students traveling through England on a night of the full moon.
Did you hear that?
I heard that.
What was it?
Could be a lot of things.
Fate let one live.
A lunatic must have been a very fierce fellow.
Wasn't a lunatic.
What?
A wolf.
Oh, be serious, would you?
And now everything is changing. Changing. Changing.
Good Lord.
John Landis, the brilliant young director of Animal House and the Blues Brothers, has turned a classic tale of terror into something new. Something different.
Excuse me.
A naked American man stole my balloon.
I'm a werewolf.
An American werewolf in London. Something different.
Hello and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and it's Halloween, everybody. And I thought the best way to celebrate it was to do another horror movie. And joining me to talk about An American Werewolf in London, which celebrates its 40th anniversary this year in 2021. Good Lord. All the way from East Proctor is my pal, Andy Leyland. Hi, Andy.
Hello, Rob. It's delightful to be here to talk about something that is so close to home.
Yeah, I am really, really excited to talk about this movie. In fact, I thought just talking about this movie wasn't going to be enough. I decided that we were going to do a full-length audio commentary over this movie. So I am just so excited because I love this movie so much. We'll talk about my history with it. We'll talk about your history with it, Andy. But everybody, we're just going to jump right to it. We're going to get right into it. So, Andy, we're going to count down. We're going to do 3, 2, 1. And when I say go, everybody, if you're watching the movie along with us, hit the play button when I say go. Luckily, there's only one cut of this movie. It's the one, the one version that exists. So everybody will be on the same page. So, okay, everybody. So, Andy, if you're ready, we'll get started.
Yep.
All right. So 3, 2, 1, go.
Go. Oh, the old Universal logo.
Oh, it's beautiful. So, Andy, let's give a little history. When did you first see this movie?
I think I saw this on video because I was about 9 when it came out.
Me too.
So I wouldn't have been going to the cinema to watch this.
Yeah, my dad took me and my sister to a lot of movies, but he would not have taken us to this. Not an R-rated horror film. I would have been 10 when this movie came out. And so, yeah, there's no way I saw this. So, yeah, like you, I must have seen it either on cable or on home video because they had just opened a video store within biking distance from my house in like 1984. And I just spent every minute of every waking hour pedaling my bike to wall-in-wall sound and video to rent every horror movie I could get my hands on because my parents weren't paying attention to what I was renting. So, of course, I went right to the horror section. So, yeah, this was this, and it became an instant favorite. I mean, I got into it from knowing John Landis. You know, I was a huge John Landis fan. He's in the Animal House, the Blues Brothers. And so the idea that he was doing a comedy horror movie was just so very exciting.
See, I don't remember if I knew it was comedy horror as a kid. I can't remember if this was one of those films that got lumped into that whole video nasties thing.
Oh, really?
In the early 80s, yeah. I don't know that this did, because I don't remember this ever being banned. But Driller Killer was banned.
Driller Killer.
Evil Dead was banned.
Right.
For a long time. And there's a bunch of those early horror movies on VHS before the BBFC came into being, which is the British Board of Film Classification, would rate the movies. It was the Wild West, so everything was getting churned out onto video. And there was this outcry from the then Conservative government that these stuff were damaging the brains of our children. Because, sure, it's not
the parents' point.
Responsibility.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not the parents' responsibility to watch what your children are watching, is it? God, no. So I don't think American Werewolf was lumped in with that. I don't think it was ever banned or anything like that, but I think it was certainly probably part of the conversation which led it to our attention. Obviously, there is no greater way of attracting a child's attention than saying, you cannot see this, as evidenced by Squid Game.
Yeah.
So, but this has National Treasure Jenny Agutter in it. So Jenny Agutter will be in trash, will she?
No. Oh, my God. My lifelong crush on Jenny Agutter started with this movie. And then I went and saw her in other movies, Logan's Run. And marvelous actress. I mean, I got to say, marvelous actress. But, God, she is so adorable in this movie. Yeah. That the crush just has endured 40 years later. Every time I see her in this movie, I just sigh. I'm like,
I still love Jenny Agutter. Mine was The Railway Children. The Railway Children was a stalwart of Christmas television schedules every year. I think it's still on every year. And Agatha is now in the position of having played both the 16-year-old lead and the mother in the remake.
Oh, wow. Oh.
So she's been in both versions of The Railway Children. And she's forever associated with that, and she doesn't seem at all bothered. But yeah, this, Logan's Run, Equus, Walkabout, everything she was ever in. Yeah,
great movie.
You don't see a lot of anymore, Walkabout, because she was only 16 at the time she filmed it. So it's a little bit problematic now. But she's in $6 Million Man. She's in Magnum P.I. She's in the 80s Twilight Zone. She's in everything.
When she shows up in the Marvel movies, I'm just happy to see her. You know, just like, there's Jenny Agutter. It's great.
Yeah. She's currently in Call the Midwife on BBC One, which has been running for over a decade.
Yep. So let me ask you, as we've seen our heroes now, we've got David and Jack, played by David Naughton and Griffin Dunne. So where, can you give us a sense, Andy, where the hell is East Proctor? Where is that in relation to, say, London?
Well, it's on the Yorkshire Moors, so they are a good 300 miles away from London.
Wow, okay.
So how they end up in a London hospital is a mystery never to be explained by the film itself.
I guess. Well, what would be the next closest town that he would end up in?
They'd take him to Leeds.
Leeds?
They'd clearly take him to Leeds, which is essentially
an American werewolf in Leeds. Yorkshire. Just doesn't have the same ring to it.
It doesn't sound as good, does it?
I love right at the very beginning, we got this guy, the Joe Belcher playing the truck driver, where he tells the guys, stay off the moors.
Yeah.
And he just says it in a very offhanded manner. And, you know, I've seen this movie literally hundreds of times at this point. And that's a line of dialogue that I've only been catching the last couple of dozen times is where, the screenplay by John Landis, he gets it right in the beginning. The guy just gives him that offhanded warning. Stay off the moors, guys. I just love that it's already been seeded in.
Yeah, the implication that this has been going on for a while is right there from the beginning. The thing that struck me watching this last night, my son Adam was there, and my wife, obviously. And I said to Adam, hey, lad, this was when movies had opening titles. Oh, when I were a lad. Because basically the opening credits of this film are just long, loving shots of the Yorkshire Moors. To the first version of Blue Moon that will appear in this film. First of three? Is the three different versions?
I think so. Yeah, we get the Bobby Vinton version playing over the credits. By the way, they mentioned the score by Elmer Bernstein. I think it is really a marvelous score. I love, in fact, it's this fade here right after they finish their knock-knock joke, where this kind of eerie music settles in. And by the way, we see the boys walking where they're not supposed to be walking. They've already been told stay off the moors, and what are they doing? They're walking. I mean, those aren't moors, but they're not staying to the road. Like, they've just been told stay on the road, and they're not doing it.
I'll tell you something. It is entirely possible that that is what's called a public footpath, believe it or not. Because just on Friday, Angela and I went for a walk just on this side of the Lake District, and the sign is public footpath. And I kid you not, Rob, there is nowhere on God's green earth that was a footpath.
Okay. All right.
So it's entirely possible they are following what is labeled as a public footpath, but it's actually a route through a farmer's field.
Wow. Oh, my Lord. So, okay. So now we've seen our sign, the slaughtered lamb, one of the great props, you know, that wonderful sign. I always wonder about towns like this, where it's like there seems to be no other business other than the slaughtered lamb. And I'm like, well, so does the slaughtered lamb just stay in business just by the regulars and that's it? Yeah. It's almost like a company town. Like all they do is make their money doing whatever they do out here. give their money to the slaughtered lamb and somehow that filters its way back to the people? Because there seems to be no other form of commerce in this town.
Yeah, again, where we went on Friday, mate, was a church, a pub, and about 6 or 7 different houses and farms. Now, I presume those people must leave that tiny little village that we went to go and work, but it was not dissimilar to this. The only difference, really, is that the pubs are now a lot more up-to-date than this one. But this one is so reminiscent of the pubs my parents would go in when I was a kid, back when we were just sat in the corner with an orange juice. and they had a raucous good time. And this is you think you'd be offended by the cliche-ridden mentality of this, but it's not. Only inaccurate.
By the way, I absolutely love the interaction they've just had with the barkeep here. Yep. And I love when she's, you know, he's like, do you have coffee? No. Do you have this? And then she says, if you want something warm, you can have tea. And then Griffin Dunn, Jack goes, so you have tea? And she goes, no. And I just love his little, oh. Just that kind of like, I just love the take of that. He's just kind of like flustered as to why is this woman making this so hard?
Well, see, that this doesn't really make sense if you think about it. She's making it hard for them to stay, so she actually doesn't want them to hang around. But later on, she's the one saying, we can't let them go.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd think she'd be welcoming them and saying, stay the night, lads. You'll be all right.
I will say that the characters in this bar, except for this guy here who's talking, Brian Glover, as the unnamed chess player, everyone's kind of inconsistent about... Yeah. Because as you just said, the barmaid seems to not want them to stay. And then at the later on, she feels bad. And then there's the guy playing the darts and David Schofield. He initially is like, you know, it's murder then. And and then later he goes and then he kind of argues with the barmaid when she's like, we need to go get them. So everyone seems to be kind of all over the place about what they're going to do with these two.
Yeah. I love the guy who's playing chess with Brian Glover is Rick Mayall.
Mm-hmm.
Who went on to be the Young Ones,
right, and one of the beloved
comedy entertainers, sadly now longer with us. At the time that this was released, again, I kid you not, Brian Glover, other than Jenny Agutter, will have been the biggest star in this movie.
Wow.
Brian Glover was a national treasure. In addition to being on everything in terms of acting, he was a regular panel guest, you know, comedy panel shows like Blankety Blank. You had Blankety Blank. You called it something different. I can't remember what it was called. You know, when you say, and we go to the town and she unzipped her blank.
Oh, Match Game. We had a that's called it, Match yeah. Game here. Yeah.
Match Game. Yeah. He was on that. And he's most famous for being the voiceover man on the Tetley teabag adverts.
Oh, wow.
he was very well known, Brian Glover.
He was also in Alien 3. And he's in A Company of Wolves, Neil Jordan's Wolves movie, just a couple of years after. Everybody's laughing way too hard at this joke. This joke is not that funny. And everybody, I love these two. We're just like, what? What the hell are you talking about? By the way, you know that this film was written by a film geek because when they're talking about werewolves, David and Jack, and he says, Lon Chaney at Universal Studios says that's the mark of the werewolf. The average person doesn't know what studio released a movie. No. Only John Landis cares about that Universal. It's a Universal Studios movie. By the way, we should mention just the brief sort of history of this. Apparently, when John Landis was working as a gopher on the 1969 movie Kelly's Heroes, which, by the way, was the original name of the Fire and Water Network, he saw a gypsy funeral. Where apparently they had put a bunch of rocks on a grave to keep the person who was in the coffin from coming out of the ground again. And he found that so interesting that he came up with the idea for this movie and sort of had it in his back pocket and wanted to make a comedy horror movie and nobody would fund it. And then, of course, he went on to do Animal House and Blues Brothers. And then he could sort of, you know, he got a blank check at that point and he used it by making this movie. The one other detail I love is that apparently at some point the studio tried to push it more as a comedy, and they initially tried to get Landis to consider John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd as Jack and David. And like that would not have worked, but man, I would love to live in the alternate Earth where that movie exists, because just what would that have looked like? You know, seeing Dan Aykroyd torn apart by wolves, you know?
You wouldn't have bought them as young backpackers for a start.
No.
You'd have instantly been like, why are these two old dudes backpacking?
Yeah, yeah. Those guys were already in their 30s.
What's interesting about this is it's not dated at all because those puffer jackets have come back in.
Yeah, it looks contemporary. I'm amazed, I think, how well this movie holds up in terms of the sort of tone and the technology. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't feel dated or anything like that, which is, again, one of the reasons I love it so much. So now they're wandering out. Here we go. Here's going to be their big mistake, is they're about to wander off onto the moors as they're having this conversation. And, you know, these two guys, I mean, they're totally plausible as best friends. They have a really amazing chemistry, and you completely buy that they are lifelong friends. I mean, part of it was in that earlier conversation where they're talking about the women that Jack wants to have sex with. Yeah. That was all mostly ad-libbed. And there's a part where even Griffin Dunne starts to laugh because his nose started to run, and he's laughing through it, and he wipes his nose, and apparently Landis gave them the off-camera indication, just keep going. And that's why it has this very unforced feel, feel to it, that this is what two guys talk about when they have hours and hours to go. By the way, how far are they walking? Like, can they walk to the next town? Isn't that really far away?
You can't. We're not a very big country, but the thing with the Yorkshire Moors is it is very, very easy to do what they've just done. Once the mist descends on the moors, it is very easy to get turned around and suddenly not be able to see where you are.
Gotcha. Okay. So there's no lights out there, right?
There's no lights out there, no. So it all feels really authentic, that bit. That was one of the things that struck me this time, because I have thought I'll just rip the piss out the geography of it. But it actually holds up really quite well if you ignore why he ends up at hospital in London. Other than that, this whole opening really does work and still holds up. Parochial small town and the pub full of the regulars. And I have been in a pub that happened. I literally walked in with a mate of mine and you heard the needle scratch.
Oh, really?
Yes, that has happened to me. That has literally happened to me. So it's very period authentic. It still feels real in how you can just lose your footing very easily once the mist descends over the moors. Wow. So all that's really quite cool. I love as well, if they have ad-libbed all this, the stuff about the girl, that comes back later. So well done.
That's just right. It does. Yeah. They talk about it later when Jack talks about his funeral. Oh, he goes, oops, stay on the moors. Oops. That's a great read. I love their noses are red. That's a great little makeup detail, that it's cold. They're wet.
It may not be makeup, mate. I'm telling you. It's cold.
Yeah. And then, let's head back, guys.
And they are both piss wet through. So they probably are genuinely freezing.
Yeah. Here we go. We're heading back. Now they're totally lost. By the way, the pentagram in the bar. What is that really meant to do? Is that meant to keep the werewolf literally out of the bar? Because outside of, like, why would it have any effect on the werewolf other than he's literally inside the bar? What else is it going to do for him?
Maybe that's why they're all in the bar.
Maybe. It's the only safe spot, I guess.
Yeah, it's the only safe space. One of the things I do like about this as well is how wonderfully lit the moors are.
Mm-hmm.
When you're out in the black like that, you cannot see your hand in front of your face. And yet this is perfectly lit.
Well, I mean, you know, you gotta do something, you know, you gotta have some. I love this crane shot here, and he's gonna kind of pull, and they're gonna stop. I love this. And then they look right in the camera.
Yep. I loved this.
Love that. They look right in the camera, and then the camera pulls off to the right, and you're like, because Landis does that in his movies. I think every movie he's virtually done is somebody's looked at the camera at some point. And it's going to actually happen again in this movie. Yeah. But I love that. I love that. It just gives an eerie kind of like, oh, all right, they're looking right at us, and here we go now. And I love how disorienting this is, because, now you have no idea where they are. I mean, there's no way to figure out what direction. I mean, you could go by the moon, you know, in a general sense of where you're going, but still, here we go. There's going to be a whammy.
They're obviously far too panicked for that. This bit's brilliant. Ball,
and he's like, you shithead. Big laugh. You can help me up? Thud. Yeah. And then wham. Oh, Lord. Oh, God. This is awful. And I love the way Landis shoots this. It's just frenetic. And he's just, the force of it is so. Look at that. He's already. Oh, he's screaming.
Can you imagine in the cinema that jump cut, that shot of everything? Oh, we're having a good laugh, and he's just falling on his ass. Yeah. Oh, that's funny. And then suddenly, wham!
And there he is.
And he's knocked out of frame.
He's flattened like that. And then he's about to get, look at that. Oh, and then he gets him.
I love the blood pumping out of the wounds as well.
Yep. Oh, and then here they go. They got him. And then I love that. I love the quiet of this. I love that Landis, there's no music. They just run in. And then he looks over and he's going to see this guy. I love that there's no explanation for this. This is just, that's the guy. That was
well, as a kid, I didn't get this.
Oh, really? You were like, who's that guy?
Yeah, I was, who's that guy? It was a couple of screenings in and a few years worth of a few years worth of growing up where I realized, oh, yeah, that's the werewolf.
There we go. Now they're going to lean in. And then
looking into the camera again.
Dark fade. I love that. That's great. It's amazing that there were three werewolf movies all around the same time. This and then Wolfen. And The Howling all came out within a year of each other, when before that there had been like a whole decade of no real budget werewolf movies. And apparently the studio had wanted some line of dialogue explaining who that guy was, and Landis resisted it because it was like, well, that's even, you know, when are you going to work that in? Anyway, here she is. Here's the beloved Jenny Agutter. I mean, good Lord. Talk about a genetic lottery. I mean, yeah. And there's John Woodvine.
John Woodvine
as the doctor. This is my favorite performance in the movie, actually.
Mine as well.
He's well
Patrick
done.
He's Patrick Stewart, isn't he?
Yes!
He's just got so much gravitas.
Yes!
So much realism to this part. And he's just so calm and laid back in his line deliveries.
Yeah.
But you never once don't buy him at all.
Yeah. He has to be skeptical throughout this whole movie, of course, because of course he is. And why would they, you know? But yet he isn't. He's willing to change his beliefs upon new evidence, which is always a nice thing to see in a movie. He doesn't stay rigid once he realizes, all right. I mean, he never fully accepts that David's a werewolf, of course, until the very end. But he at least has the idea of, well, if he thinks he's a werewolf, he could be a danger to other people. And that's his concern. So yeah, he's great. I love the look she's already giving him. Look at her. She's like, oh my God.
Well, I love Woodvine's performance. He comes across in the initial bit as a gruff doctor, but when she walks out, there's a little hint of a smile there.
There you go, right there. He just did it. Yeah. He's like,
and later on, he's got that old phone side conversation going on about he's forced to go out for a meal with this guy that he really doesn't want to go out for.
Roger Matheson.
So he's just so good in it. I think he is the MVP. It's him that sells it.
Yeah.
Because he's essentially the audience identifier, isn't he? I don't really buy that this is a werewolf, but the more he investigates.
Oh, here we are. Frank Oz.
Frank Oz as
Mr. Collins. There must be something about John Landis's relationship with Frank Oz, and that he always casts Frank Oz as an authoritarian dick.
Yeah.
He's the guy running the jail, like the jailhouse.
One prophylactic.
Yeah. One hat, black, in the Blues Brothers. He's a cop in Trading Places. He's the one who kind of frames Dan Aykroyd with the PCP. You know what this stuff does to kids? He's always kind of a dick. So I think that's I love this. Hi. It's got that Grover Miss Piggy voice. And he comes in at exactly the wrong moment. Poor Jack is having to deal with the news, or David having to deal with the news that his friend is dead. By the way, wonderfully delivered by John Woodvine. I love when he says, it's going to be quite a
John Woodvine's brilliant.
Your friend is dead.
Frank Oz is wonderfully uncomfortable through this entire scene. And he's far more concerned with being seen as to having done the right thing.
Yeah.
Because he keeps looking at Alex. Like, look, I'm doing my job.
Mr. Kessler. He's such a jerk. Such a jerk. Oh my God.
And I'm pretty confident that Jenny Agutta stoked the fuel about the fantasy about nurses for an entire generation.
Oh my Lord. Oh my God. She's just so gorgeous and so sweet. And again, we'll get to it later on. Some of the stuff she says to him is just like, oh yeah, this is what you want. This is what you would want.
But she's a manic pixie dream girl.
Oh, she sure is. Oh Lord. I love the stupid kids. I'll appreciate anything. The doctor's like, all right, just get out. Is there whatever? I don't care.
Well, I read an interview with Agutta in preparation for this, and she said exactly what you just said. She said, John Landis would just let you riff, and he would just keep the camera running. And you would occasionally be like, are we not cutting? And if he didn't stay cut, you just kept going.
Yeah. Now, there was the earlier line with the other nurse where she mentions that she thinks David's a Jew because she looked at his penis.
Yes. That's very professional behavior that would not be tolerated today. No.
But that's something in the I have like the Steelbook edition of this movie on Blu-ray, and there's a whole documentary about the sort of the implications of that, and that there is a lot of kind of references to Judaism in this film, and it's the sort of the idea that he's an outsider in this culture. And then, of course, later on, they're going to get that dream sequence where we kind of have these monsters dressed as Nazis. Once it's pointed out, you can't help but see it. But I will admit, it wasn't until the documentary that even occurred to me.
Yeah.
I love this whole bit about Roger Mathis. I love the skull. He's got a skull on his desk with pencils in it.
The set dressing in his office is brilliant. Like, there are just piles of books on the floor that he's obviously just not got shelves for.
So here are
these two coppers.
Yeah, Don McKillop as Inspector Villers and Paul Kember as Sergeant McManus. Yeah. This whole little idea that obviously Inspector Villers looks down on Sergeant McManus quite a bit. And then it's funny, we're going to find out that McManus ends up being kind of right about this. Villers is the one who's kind of ignoring it all.
Yeah, McManus ends up being the one who's open to investigating this case further.
Yep.
And he's shut down by the powers that be, which has been a story in the news, a lot more serious than this, obviously, concerning the death of a young person of color called Stephen Lawrence, that the higher up shut the case down. Hmm. And one copper had to keep going, no, we keep this case open. So there's precedence for the old guard just shutting a case down because they just want it to be over with.
Wow.
Although that is hysterically funny with the bedpans.
The bedpans, the noisiest things imaginable that they could have found. So this, by the way, the actor Paul Kember here, he's had quite a nice career. He was in The Great Train Robbery, The Long Good Friday. Again, no surprise, a lot of these people, just a ton of British television. These are all British actors. But he's in a bunch of other things. I love that painting on the wall of the flowers. It's a sort of pallid, boring.
I love his tie. I love that the back half of his tie, the long thin bit, is longer than the front bit.
He's got, definitely kind of a schlub. Here we go. Now Jack's figuring out David is figuring out what's going on. David Naughton, we should talk about David Naughton just a little bit. It is amazing to me how cruel Hollywood can be, because this is a guy that really had been in TV and then had been in the Dr. Pepper commercials here. That was his real claim to fame in America. And then he got plucked to star in a movie like this, which was a giant hit. And it really seemed to do not much of anything for his career. No. If you look at his IMDb, his second credit after this movie is an episode of The Love Boat. It's like that. You would think that he would have had a chance to star in at least a couple of movies and see if they flopped before he kind of got relegated to, B-grade stuff. Yeah.
It's like Griffin Dunne didn't seem to do anything acting-wise. It's only when you investigate further, he's had a big career behind the camera.
Well, I mean, look, just a couple of years later, he would star in After Hours, directed by Martin Scorsese, and not that was a huge hit, but nevertheless, I mean, you're starring in a movie by Martin Scorsese, you're doing it right for yourself. So here we go. Now here's David running.
Well, going to what we're on about earlier, I do feel awfully sorry for David Naughton having to run through the woods nude.
Oh, man.
He must have been freezing cold.
Here we go. This is great. This is awful. Ah! Ugh.
Okay. See, what's the thing with it is, the thing that why it works as well as it does is the comedy's funny, but the horror is horrific.
Yeah. Yeah, both are played straight. Oh, my God, I love this kid that we're about to see.
Yeah, I love this
Colin Fernandez as Benjamin. First of all, the kid after my own heart, he's reading comic books. Here's Jenny Agutter talking about his comic books, which is some sort of weird fetish of mine now. But Jenny Agutter, what a lovely bunch of comics you've got. Do you like them? I hear that in my dreams. But this kid is so cute. I love that he just says no. Oh, no. It's so cute. And she's charmed by him. And then this kid, the lovely bunch of comics you've got.
That kid comes and nicks his copy of the Dandy.
Then he goes and just, bam, hits her right in the butt. Yeah.
Interesting about that as well is he is reading a load of British comic books.
Yeah, right. Laurel and Hardy. Laurel and Hardy,
which was based on the cartoon Laurel and Hardy.
Larry Harmon cartoon. Yeah.
Yeah.
Think about, Andy, there's a kid out there about our age who got to say, I smacked Jenny Agutter on the butt.
Yeah.
Good for you, buddy.
I'm sure we're not at all jealous of him.
Yeah. That kid, by the way, the Colin Fernandez, this is his only credit. So I'm probably not an actor, probably just the son of somebody that could do it. But boy, he's adorable. I generally don't like little kids in movies because I just find them to be cloying, but that kid's really cute.
He was quite cute.
No. Here we go. Now this, again, she's already flirting with him big time, where the whole bit where she's like, you know, you have to take your pills after your food. He's like, no, I'm not hungry. He's not, he's, I don't think he's understanding yet that she's into him. He's just, he's flirting a little bit, but it's, it seems more innocent. But it, I mean, when she says, you know, what kind of nurse would I be if I failed such a simple task? I feel like she is already, you know, like kind of into him.
Yeah. Which, again, not the most professional of behaviors.
No, no.
Oh, I mean, God. I presume that the American embassy is paying for his private room.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of amazing. Yeah, it's amazing that, like, his parents never come to see him. We never find out why they don't make it. Now, there is a, we'll talk about an alternate version of this movie, which I did not know exists. I did not know existed until you told me about it, Andy.
To learn that you didn't know that existed. Yeah, I was quite surprised. Because Dirk Manx, who did the audio version of this, did an awful lot of stuff like that. He did Independence Day UK, which was basically, what were we doing while Will Smith was punching out ETs?
Okay. Well, let's talk about it. Yeah, in anticipation of this, everybody, Andy said, I assume you're familiar with the radio version. And my answer was, what radio version? and yes, in 1991, there was an audio version featuring Jenny Agutter and John Woodvine playing their roles again. It was amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, right. And Brian Glover. And
I'm Brian Glover, yeah, because it focuses a lot more on Brian Glover.
It sure does.
And we learn that it's Brian Glover's family that are the werewolves.
Yep.
There's another. And he's the police sheriff equivalent, police constable of that small little village.
I enjoyed it as an alt. Oh, this is great. I love this image here of where she walks up. Now she's in the dreams now. Now the dreams are ramping up. And wham, there you go. And, you know, the implicit idea that she's now under threat from this curse. But anyway, the radio version, I mean, I didn't think it was that great because I thought the two actors playing David and Jack were just not anywhere near as good as David Naughton and Griffin Dunne. But it was great to hear this. Again, it was like an Earth 2 version of the story, you know. And it reads like a novelization where they know they have to kind of pad the story out a little. So there's a lot more information. And there's even a scene where we find out that David's parents are on their way to come visit him, and like the plane gets hijacked or something. It's just very strange.
Yeah, they do actually explain why his parents haven't shown up after 3.5 weeks.
Yeah, you would think they would hop on a plane. I mean, there was enough time to send Jack back and bury
him. Home, yeah.
Back home, you know, and bury him, you know. So here we go. Now he's talking. Dr. Hirsch is like, I love the idea of, if there was a maniac on the loose, we have heard it on the telly.
I love this entire bit where he says, look, if you're gonna go insane, wait 2 more days so you're not my problem.
I like how honest he is about that. He's just like, look, I'm in charge of you for the next 2 days. Can you just keep it together and drop all this werewolf business? Come on. You know? I love all that. It's great.
And he gets to have Jenny Agutter read to him in bed,
She's reading a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. And you know, we're here to analyze this movie. I assume that the reason that she's reading that is because that's about somebody dropped into an unfamiliar world. You know,
well, the passage she reads is very, that's David.
Oh, right. Yes, of course. Right. The part that she, yes.
So it's quite kind of like, that's why she's reading this. But when you see her later on, she's got loads of books everywhere as well. So
she's also a big movie fan. Again, you know, this is a John Landis movie where characters have movie posters on walls, which you hardly ever see in movies unless the director is a movie nerd and then they put those things in. But yeah, she's good. She's the perfect woman. She really is. She's a nerd, beautiful nurse who loves movies. I mean, come on.
Yep. Yes.
Oh, he's fallen for her. You could tell by the way he's looking at her. He's smitten, which again, how could you not be? I mean, she's just looking, look how happy he looks. He's just like, okay.
Here we go. This last night, the Muppet Show's on. So I'm like, all right, so this is Sunday evening there, because that's when the Muppet Show aired. But obviously this scene isn't over here. This scene is back in America.
Right. It is amazing to me that Jim Henson allowed this. I know that he was friends with John Landis through Frank Oz. But I mean, Jim Henson rightfully was very, very protective of the Muppets and did not want them to ever appear to be too hard-edged or too color, and to have them even interacting in this scene, which is filled with incredible violence, is pretty shocking. Here we go. Now, the Nazi pig people.
Nazi werewolves.
Nazi werewolf pig people. There we go. Now, somehow that guy got in, and there we go. They all get shot. And we even see the Muppet there, like, bang, there we go. Now they're out. And the kids get killed. I mean, oh, my Lord.
And then look at the state of them on the floor, though.
Yeah. Oh, my. Yeah, this is just horrendous. When I was a kid, this scene really... It was funny. I've read reviews of this movie, and this is the scene that a lot of critics tend to crap on because they think it looks so
cheap. Right?
Here we go. It's going to be the double blind.
I don't think it looks cheap, but I think putting that there really wakes you up to the fact that, yes, this is a horror movie. So far, it's been quite... There's been a couple of scares, but so far, it's been this quite amiable, light entertainment comedy with great acting, and then they do that.
Like,
you do not do that to National Treasure Jenny Agutter.
No. Oh, and her body's twitching. Oh, my God. Yep. But, I mean, I love that it's so weird. That's what I liked about it, is that it doesn't have any literal sense. Why are they dressed like Nazis? Why are they wielding machine guns? Why do they look like kind of pig people as opposed, you know? And, like, I just like that it's so strange that it doesn't fit. This guy, I love
I love this hospital porter. Last night we watched this. Angela, my wife, works for the NHS. She said, "That's not an NHS breakfast."
Was this more deluxe than what the NHS would provide?
Oh, far, yes. You'll get a couple of pieces of toast, and that's probably
okay.
It. But even here, I love that he puts the spoon in the porridge
straight up. It is a pretty big meal. There's like toast and here we go. There's our hero. There's the first of his makeups, amazing work by Rick Baker. I mean, just unbelievable. Yeah. I love, and again, this is one of those things where it's, you know, accidental. There's that little piece of flesh that's dangling off of Jack's neck that gives it just that extra bit of like, you know, just it's like, but this is just, and Griffin Dunne's performance is just
marvelous. He's brilliant in it. Of them, I honestly thought he would have gone on to be a major star, because the way he just handles all of these scenes in particular.
Look at that.
Just his line delivery and the way he handles it, and the way he plays the comedy of the scene, despite looking like that.
Yeah. Apparently, when
he's discussing his own funeral, and he's just so matter of fact about it.
Yeah, I love the death. Life mocks me even in death, and he's still bothered by the fact that the girl that he liked went and jumped in the bed of Mark Levine. I love that this is somebody, of course, we'll never meet, but I love that Mark Levine. Even David's a little like an asshole. Life mocks me even in death. Here, I love this little where he's gonna jump. He's gonna yell at him, David. He's just doing it just to be a dick. I love this. Oh, the makeup.
He plays it so well, doesn't he? This whole The Walking Dead, but a bit of a dick, but likable.
Yeah.
He's still a likable asshole.
Oh, God. The makeup. It's so hard to do this kind of makeup, I would imagine, because you can only add on to somebody. You can't take away from somebody. But it looks like all the flesh is, you know, engaged or engorged. Like, it has that kind of, like, bloated look, which I think makes the neck is all that stuff is. Just amazing. And
only around his eye, isn't it? It's only around his eye that you're looking at it going, you can see where they've pasted the latex on. Everywhere else is still really convincing.
Yeah, I love this. You'll kill now. It's all real. It's all true.
I love as well, if you have a look, the blood is coming out of all the wounds.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Have you ever talked to a dead person? It's boring. It really is just an amazing... He's making the makeup work for him. So many actors, when they get buried in this stuff, you know, they lose themselves. But he really is... I mean, part of it is the makeup here is still mostly his face. There, I love that little look that he knows Alex is coming. Now... In your opinion, Andy, is this really happening, or is this all in David's mind?
I think he thinks he's really seeing him. I don't think he is actually seeing him. No, I think.
Okay, if Alex had walked in a second earlier, she would not have seen him.
Yeah, he's essentially talking to thin air.
Okay, gotcha. All right,
that's my take on it. Anyway,
because now it makes me wonder: is the toast gone? Is there any of the food? Yeah. Now they just kissed each other. So now they've ramped things up a notch. Her eyes, man. Good Lord.
It's very perky.
Oh, your dead friend.
I did make a pact with myself when I said I'd do this with you, that we wouldn't turn it into a Jenny Agutter love fest.
It's hard not to. I mean, she's so marvelous in this movie. I mean, again, I think all the performances are great. We already talked about John Woodvine is great, but she's the only woman in the movie.
Essentially, of any
real note in terms of the character that you get to know. And you have to buy that she would fall for him so quickly. I mean, you have to do a lot of the work in that she's just got something in her where she likes the kind of lost puppy dog kind of guy. We are.
You have to buy into the relationship for the ending to work. And that is all in the hands of the actors.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean,
because the script, let's be brutally honest, the script does not give her a lot to work with.
No,
not really.
No. And this is a short movie. I mean, this is like a 95 minute movie. Yeah. I mean, this is not, I like this little detail here about inflation.
Where she's keeping her eye on what she spends. That's still topical for nurses.
That's great. I love that little throwaway detail of like, you know, okay, this is hard. She's a working girl, as she puts it. I like that. Here's all the punks on the tube here.
I don't recall ever seeing any that amount of punks on the London Underground.
Okay. That guy's hair. How long did it take that guy to do his hair with those patterns and the purple? And he looks like Two-Face, for God's sake. That took a lot of work.
He does have a Two-Face vibe going on.
He does.
On,
oh, my God.
The thing we're watching this now, they all look about 12.
Oh, they do. I know. Yeah, look at them all. Look at us. Oh. Here we go. She's
now, this is quite cool, actually, because in an awful lot of places in London now, you can't drive. Certainly the Piccadilly Circus is later. The road is never as busy as now because of congestion charge, and they've rerouted a lot of the roads, so they're more pedestrianised.
Oh.
But she's got her little flat here in this house. But as you look down that road, as David opened the door, then I would swear that's the street where the prisoner lives in the opening credits. Patrick McGoohan's the prisoner. I would swear blind that that's where he gets gassed.
Okay, that's great. Oh, so
I don't know that it is.
Right. She has a Casablanca poster on the wall. Yeah,
she has a Gone with the Wind on somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. It's amazing that you're supposed to clear this stuff, but Landis didn't. You know, he just put it in there. You're supposed to apparently get clearances. He just put it on the wall because I mean, she's got. We'll see a scene later on, obviously, where Mickey Mouse is involved, and like you have to clear that with Warner Brothers or with Disney.
That
and Landis didn't.
Me
he
more
just did it
than the Muppet Show. That's surprising that Mickey and Minnie Mouse are in. And the only thing I can think of is as a 14-year-old girl, Jenny Agutter acted in the Disney Club, and I can only think that gave her a little bit of pull. To allow Mickey and Minnie to appear in this. Because again, to actually have Disney characters, they would not allow that nowadays.
No, not in a horror movie. Here, I love this line. She talks about her lovers. She's had 7 lovers, 3 of them one night stands, which is, I'm sorry, that's the greatest one night stand of all time. If you brought home Nurse
one
Price.
One of them was Logan 5, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And then I love this line about, I find you very attractive and a bit sad, which is, I feel like that's my fiance talking to me.
There's a certain element of pity. Is that what you're saying?
A little bit. A little bit.
What I like about this as well, one of the things you see in TV and films all the time is they've made a big deal about her job and they've made a big deal about the rate of inflation and her pay. And then she has these glorious apartments. And she doesn't. She has a realistic sized apartment, especially in London.
Right, not these huge bay windows overlooking the park or whatever.
No, so, she's got a living room, she's got a bathroom, she's got a closet, she's got a bedroom.
Yep.
And that's it.
Yeah, there we go. Here's the big love scene. Yeah, it's you watch. The other night, we were watching When Harry Met Sally, and I love that movie. It's a great movie. But when you see that movie, Billy Crystal's apartment is the kind of thing Oprah would have. Like, it's like this, these huge windows.
You're
like,
Superman.
Yeah. It's like she's got a penthouse report. What kind of coin is she pulling in as a reporter here? A friend of mine on Twitter was talking about that she was introducing this movie to her child, her 10-year-old child, for the first time, and his only question was, When is the sex scene over? That was all he wanted to know.
Well, this isn't as raunchy as you remember it, is it? You remember it being a lot raunchier than this.
I mean, it's pretty.
You wouldn't get it nowadays.
No, as a kid, I didn't fully understand the implications of what they're saying here. As an adult, yes, I do. But as a kid, I was like, well, okay, he's disappearing out of the frame and she's writhing. I don't know what that means. Well, now right.
This bit here, where young Andrew fell in love with women's hips. I can pinpoint the exact moment.
Yeah, here we go. Yeah. The MPAA is very, very skittish about any implications of women receiving oral sex. Almost every movie.
Why?
I don't know why. Every movie... Yeah. That seems to have that scene gets an NC-17 and then the poor director has to like fight it. I don't know why the studio is such a tight ass about this. Because
I feel so bad for their wives.
There's a blowjob joke in Ghostbusters for Pete's sakes. That's a family entertainment movie. There's a blowjob joke. But in any movie, there was Blue Valentine. There's an oral sex scene in that. And then The History of Violence, there's a sex scene. And both those movies got NC-17 for that scene. And both directors had to be like, come on, and fight it down. It's ridiculous. So here we go. Now we're going to get our second great reveal here of that he can't get away from. You've been without Jack just long enough to kind of almost forget about it.
Yep.
And then
I think it's all going back to normal. And then there he is. I love his invariant
whammo
composure every time you see him.
It's great. You're not real. I love that. It's great.
I love that he's green now.
Yeah, his body is, turning. I love this. He checks in on her. A nurse, huh?
So do they eventually decompose to the point where they're just walking skeletons?
I guess so. I guess if he had kept meeting him, he would have eventually just been. I love that. I see now, I like this little moment here where Jack opens the curtain and then he sniffs the flowers. And it's like, I feel like this is, like David's not seeing this. We're seeing this. So I feel like it's really happening. Because we're the only viewers of that moment. So it's like Jack must really be there in some respects.
Yeah, well, see, there is. I don't think he is. But see, that Mickey Mouse. But
hi, David.
If he's not really there, who's picking up Mickey Mouse?
That's amazing.
Because he has to be there because he's got to tell David the plot, basically.
Yep.
So how does David know all this if he isn't there?
Yep.
He can't know something he doesn't know if this is all in his head.
Right. Right.
So there must be some kind of physical manifestation of some kind.
Yeah. I love that he's kidding around at the beginning and then it gets more serious. You know, I love it as he's, well, I'm going to turn into a werewolf. And he goes, yeah, that's right. Like he's amazed that his friend gets it. But now I love the stare. His eyes are getting there. We see his hand all messed up. But I like that his brow starts to furrow and it just gets more serious. Like he's like, David, I'm not kidding around here. You have to do this.
It only really becomes real to him once he starts killing people.
Well, of course. I mean, sure. I mean, you have to imagine.
Because at the moment, he's still like, you're talking bollocks, mate.
Yeah, this is... God damn it, David. Please believe me. Yeah. I'm not having a lot of fun here.
I'm sorry. I love that line. I'm not having a good time here.
Yeah.
He needs to move on, and you're preventing me from moving on.
That's a great out now. I love this detail that she's wearing his t-shirt.
Yep.
Boy, that is, again, we're trying to keep this from being the Jenny Agutter appreciation hour, but that is, lordy. That is, to me, that is her most attractive, that moment of her and just the t-shirt.
I believe that too.
Oh,
yeah.
Now he's gone. Now, obviously, she's come out. He's gone.
Yeah. So that's what I mean. Is it in his head?
Yeah.
I don't know now.
And she was just sitting in the chair that he was sitting in.
Yeah. He is imparting information that he needs to know that he can't know.
Yep.
So I don't know.
Here they have another conversation about a movie. Have you ever seen The Wolfman? And she says, the one with Oliver Reed. He's, no, the Universal one. I love that. Again, Alex Price has seen the Hammer Horror Curse of the Werewolf. She's a movie fan. Oh, again, she is the manic pixie dream girl. She really is.
before that was even a thing.
Before that was even a thing, yeah. Oh, my Lord. He's great.
And the thing about this as well is looking back at it now and seeing all the things like the old phone, the old rotary phones and the old red telephone boxes and all that stuff that just aren't really around anymore.
I love her line read where she says, I think you're very sad. Like she says, I think you feel guilty about your friend David, but your friend Jack being gone. I love that she really does have a nice, I mean, here she's laughing at him, but I love that she's got real, you know, she has real pity for him because she realizes he's feeling incredibly guilty that he's got survivor's guilt. Yeah. He's got survivor's guilt.
She is understanding of the fact that he is going through something.
Yep. And there is that moment where, of course, when the werewolf attacks, he runs away. And then he feels, you know, he realizes he's got to turn back. And by then it's too late. But he does have that moment of like, you know, in the split second, he took off. Because of course he would. I mean, you would just panic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what was he going to do anyway? I mean, you don't want to leave your friend behind, but what's he going to do?
He'd have probably died as well. Yeah. Him running away is what kept him alive.
Yeah. 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 So here we go now.
He was away long enough for the people with the guns to show up.
Yeah.
None of those places are real.
Lesher and Airwood?
Nope.
Oh, those are all. So East Proctor is real, but the other two are fake?
No, none of them are real, I don't think.
What, East Proctor is not a real place?
Not that I know of.
Oh, I thought maybe it was. I had no idea.
No, I don't think East Proctor's real. You're going to make me look it up, though.
Okay. So, now, this is a lot of legwork that Dr. Hirsch is doing here. And this says something wonderful about him as a person, that he's willing to do all this. Because, as you just pointed out, it's like, what, you said 200-300 miles a drive? So, yes. I mean, this is a lot of commitment on Dr. Hirsch's part.
Yeah, he's a day. It's a day's drive for him.
Wow. All right.
Oh, no, the slaughtered lamb is the black swan in Martyrs Green in Surrey.
Okay. That's great. Oh, God. That'd be great. I think they're all looking. The little head nod Rick Mile does. The guy, the other guy's like, should we talk to him? And Rick Mile's like, no, don't talk to him. He says something to eat? Nothing. Oh.
Yeah, the actual village is called Crickerdale. I didn't think East Proctor was a real place. I love Brian Glover in the background, though, just watching him.
Yep. Yeah, who's he playing chess with? They sit in front of a chessboard, there's nobody there.
Because Rick Mayall's now playing what's it called? With the little blocks with the pictures on. Oh, I cannot for the life remember what it's called.
Oh, I don't even know.
It'll come back to me when I'm not thinking about it.
I love how Dr. Hirsch is kind of playing dumb a little.
Yes.
Like he's sort of, you know, he's being really in it. I mean, he's there to investigate, but he's pretending that he's not. So he's like, oh, that thing that happened a couple of weeks ago? Yeah, yeah. He's kind of trying to lure them in a little. I thought, what?
Yeah, he's making out he stumbled upon this place as accidentally and heard about it in the news or something so that they'll say something.
There you go. He has a little swig of the Guinness there. I even love that, the little swipe of the foam off of his face. I've been there for 200 years. How long has the slaughtered lamb been in business? It's been there for 200 years.
How long have these werewolves been in his family?
Yeah, is somebody going to do him anything about this? Like, good Lord.
Well, if he's the constable and his family have been the constable, as in the radio show, then he's probably been covering it up.
Wow.
Yeah, he's playing chess against nobody.
Yeah. Okay.
Because he has mentioned earlier on that the wounds were dressed before they came to him.
Right.
So you've still got the thing as Wytek in 300 miles away. What's the equivalent of that in America? Is it him having an accident in LA and waking up in a hospital in New York?
No, that would be thousands of miles. But, I mean, I would imagine it would be similar to getting injured in Los Angeles and they take you to say almost like San Francisco. You're like, you wouldn't do that. Like, you know, there are people when they have to travel from San Francisco to LA, they fly because it's such a long, it's an 8-hour, 9-hour drive. So you wouldn't do that. So, by the way, I should mention Lila Kay is the barmaid here. There she is. Again, she's got a lot of TV credits, as you might expect. The only other movie I think I've ever seen her in, she was in Nuns on the Run with Eric Idle. Oh, I saw that movie.
Coltrane. Oh, not a high point of either one of the CVs.
Well, you know. And then he said David Schofield, as I mentioned, is he's only credited as dart player. He's got a lot of credits. He was in Pirates of the Caribbean, yep. Valkyrie, Gladiator. Yep. He's still working now, so he's had quite a good career. And a lot of British TV. Virtually, I was going through the IMDb of all these British actors. Everybody's been on Doctor Who. Yes. Every one of them has a Doctor Who credit. This is great. I love this. I love that Dr. Hirsch feels it. Like, I feel like somebody's watching me. There he is.
Yeah, he's going to tell him something. There's a lot of familiar faces in this. There's one later on, I'll point to you when we get there. He literally has one or two lines in this movie, and he's actually gone on to be a really renowned character actor.
Okay, cool.
Must be one of his earliest performances.
I love finding that stuff. When we've been doing the movie minute shows, and you see somebody who has like one line in Superman 3, and you're like, yeah, they went on to be, you know, they're like in like 17 blockbusters. You're like, wow, that's amazing.
Well, I don't know if you've got to it yet. This is an aside. At the end of Superman 3, the cool man is Larry Lamb. He's a massive star over here.
Yes, he was. He's in Empire Strikes Back. And yeah, we did get to that. It's amazing. Here we go. Yeah. There's something terrible about this place.
I love that they're all doing Yorkshire accents as well, but they're trying to do them in such a way that they're palatable for an American audience.
Oh, really? Is that okay? Yeah. Okay.
Because nothing amuses me more than discovering that Trainspotting had to be dubbed and they had to de-emphasize some of the Scottish accents.
Oh, wow. Oh, I love that. That's enough. Now, it's amazing to me that Hirsch just lets him walk away. Like, you would think Dr. Hirsch would say, wait a minute. What did I just witness here? Like, what's the cover up? But instead, presumably, he just goes home. He just drives home at that point. And maybe he figures that Brian Glover's not going to tell him anything, but obviously something's happening.
He's not going to get anything else out of that. They know he's digging now.
Yeah. I love that.
That's enough! Look at all those old cars.
Oh, here we go. Oh, here now, these two little girls.
Who are not in any way creepy.
They're literally credited as creepy little girl and creepy little
girl. Yes, they are at the end, aren't they?
Yeah. Claudine Bauer and Johanna Creighton. There they are. They find it. Now, the dog knows. The dog knows something's up.
Yeah, the dog. You always trust your animals, man.
There you go.
There's a reason they kept all those Alsatians around in the Terminator.
One of the girls, Johanna Creighton, I don't know which one is which, has only ever been in this movie. And then the other girl was in some British television and that's it. So neither one of them went on to anything particularly famous. So he's locked out. All right.
Hey, the cat doesn't like him either.
No.
See, it's amazing this watching this now, right? It's like how much London's changed and how little London has changed. That's a lovely touch that his feet are dirty.
Yeah, I know. That's great. It makes sense because he's been, walking on a windowsill, sure.
But how many times do you see in films, they'll put the feet up on a table and the shoes are pristine?
Yeah.
And they've literally just come in from outside. The shoes should have dirt on them or whatever, or be scuffed. Yep. And they never are. Always takes me out of a film, that. It's one of those weird little things that bugs you. See those mini? I love that TV. I love that old television.
Oh, and that's great, like this whole I bit.
Yep.
Now, okay, now.
There's the test card. Love the test card. BBC Two showing the darts.
Now, you have to explain this whole Nina Carter thing. Because what this is, because when I was a kid, it was so strange to me that it seemed like on broadcast television, they were showing, it's not porn, but it was, it's pretty saucy stuff. They're kind of, news of the world talking about this woman, and she's like, I've had a lot of lovers, and I don't regret all of it. I don't regret any of it. Like, what was this whole bit with these?
This advert is remarkably authentic. No word of a lie. This is what the News of the World did every week. The News of the World was a Rupert Murdoch owned shit rag.
Oh,
you may have to bleep that now. I do apologize. Well, that's what it was. It basically got shut down not that long ago in the old investigation into the death of a young girl where they were found to have been hacking people's phones.
Oh, that's the thing that Hugh Grant got involved in.
Yeah.
Right.
And the News of the World got shut down rather than go to court. But that kind of story, Page Three Girls and the lascivious affairs with politicians and stuff happened all the time in the 80s. And Nina Carter is genuinely still around.
She has a website.
Yep. She went on to have a big pop career with another blonde Page Three girl, I believe.
There you go. So the whole bit was just that it was interviews with women and talking about their sexual background, their sexual history.
These Page Three girls have basically got involved with politicians or public figures of some kind, and then they'd sell the story to a rag newspaper.
There you go. Okay. Here we go. Now we got John Fogerty here. This is great. Great song. Apparently, John Landis wanted to use Bob Dylan's cover of Blue Moon, which appeared on his 1970 album Self-Portrait, but apparently he could not clear it to be in the movie. Dylan was not clearing that much of his music at this point, so could not get it, which, you know, I mean, it's fine. I mean, you know, the music in this is great, but I mean, for my personal interest, it would have been great to hear Bob show up in this movie, because I love this movie so much. But so I love that he's just bored out of his mind. He's just like, there's nothing to do. There's no TV to watch.
We had three television channels in 1981.
I mean, she's got a lot of books to read. He could. By the way, there's Daffy Duck. Or, I mean, a Donald Duck on the
Donald Duck. Yeah,
yeah. There he goes. Right up. Walks right up against it.
She's got a VCR. He could go and rent a film.
Yeah, there you go.
I do love how a TV, though, is situated so it is nowhere that is comfortable in that living room for us to sit and watch it.
Where do you point your chairs at? She's got. Yeah. You mentioned she's got a VCR, 1981. That's pretty ahead of the curve, right? I didn't have it.
We got ours in 82, because the first thing I set was the TV premiere of Star Wars.
Well, oh, here's Benjamin again.
I love it. No.
No. No. I love
the authentic attention to detail. He's got the things on his wrist with his name and blood type and stuff.
Oh, it's great. I love when she says, Benjamin, have you ever been beaten severely about the head and face, the face and body? I love that. I love that she's kind of kidding around with him. It's so cute. And then she jumps. No. This is so adorable.
You get the impression that she does work with the kids because she's good with them. So it does beg the question how she ended up looking after him.
Yeah. Why is she involved with David? She's a pediatric nurse. That's a whole separate discipline. So, all right, here we go. I love how much it just comes on him like a whammy. He's just sitting there and then bam. It seems terrifying that it could hit you like that. It's not it's not Lon Chaney. It's you're fine. And then all of a sudden you're in absolute agony. I think that's a really terrifying idea.
And it's what's it as well? Sans CG. This took him forever to film.
Oh man. Yeah, this is.
I love that. I love that the hand's just out of shot.
There we go. So
you don't see they're going to fake grow. One.
There we go. Oh, that's got to hurt. That He's has got to hurt. He sure does. Look at that.
Because this took him days, didn't it?
Yeah. I mean, Rick Baker complained about this a little and said that the fact that it's such lighting, like it's not shrouded in darkness, that he felt like, you know, he kind of Landis put the whammy on him a little, and that it was like there's no place to hide these effects. Now,
that's why it works.
Right, but that's exactly right. That's exactly why it worked. Here's the last joke we're going to get. I'm sorry, I called you a meatloaf, Jack. This is the last moment he's going to have to be sort of his own personality. But yeah, that's why it works, is that it is so just look at it. Here it is. We're looking right at it.
Yeah, it's in the harsh light of light bulbs in somebody's living room.
Yep.
It's not in an alleyway, it's not at night outside anywhere. And that's why it works. And now, it still works.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's amazing how much it holds. Now, people have pointed out, when he's in wolf form, how the hell does he get out of the apartment? But the door's open. We see the door is open. Hmm. And I think even the window's open. Now, you got to wonder, what if she's looking right in the camera again. What are her neighbors thinking during all this? They're right? Are none of them home? Like, somebody must be like, what is going on? Alex's apartment. There's some guy screaming bloody murder. Oh, look at that. A shot of Mickey Mouse in the middle of all this. Yeah. Oh my God. Disney would never
happen today.
No.
This is my favorite bit, though.
The face.
Where the elongated snout and the teeth.
Oh.
And the dew claw, though, sticking out the side of his foot. It's just so.
Now, this scene is in darkness. We've got this brief scene where it's everything, all of a sudden the lights are out. But it works because, you know, I never really even thought about it, that all of a sudden the lights are out. But then it's going to cut right to the moon. So, like, okay, obviously some more time has passed. And, you know, maybe knocked the light over. He knocked the lamp over or something. It's dark.
Yeah, I think we should have seen a shot of him, like, him knocking a lamp over or something. Yeah.
So here we go. Now, this is a detail that I found very funny from the radio version, in that Dr. Hirsch goes on and on about Roger Matheson. Yep. He doesn't want to have to spend any time with this guy, Roger Matheson. In the audio version, this is Roger Matheson.
This is Roger Matheson.
So yeah. This is that. Now, I like that we don't see that in the movie because it's a little too small. Like, would London have 8 people in it? But
yes,
it's a fun detail that, like, oh, this could be Roger Matheson. This poor girl, the wife, yes. She's so sweet. And it's
even
all
after death.
Yeah, even after death. She's, but it's like the reason they die is because they want to pull a little prank.
Yeah.
And it's like, what
have been the wrong plus.
Yeah. Oh, it's awful. Just awful. Now, I believe this is Jeffrey Burridge as Harry and Brenda Cavendish as Judith. I believe this is who they're bam. She gets it right on the side there. And then, ooh, and then. No, so wait, so this is Roger Matheson.
Hooligans
this
are in the park again.
Yeah.
Does that remind you of that Bill Hicks skit? Yeah, oh, the hooligans are loose again.
There we go. And then we know the quick cut. Just, oh, and there we go. Oh, awful. Just awful.
Yeah. That's terrible, isn't it?
I love her. I love she's. You can see her through the glass. Is it? Yes, doctor. I've seen him. I like that he doesn't waste time. There's no scene of him castigating her for having an affair. No, they just skip over that. I think that's great.
He's basically set him up.
Yeah.
Hasn't he? Let's be honest.
Yes, that's true. Now, I'll tell you, this scene here with presumably, again, this is Roger Matheson wandering out. I always thought that he died too when he steps in the pile of goo, but they don't actually suggest that. For some reason, as a child, I always... like seem to remember that he got attacked too, but he doesn't. He just steps in the viscera, and then there's this kind of comedic take of him looking up. We'll get to it in a second. But he actually doesn't die. We never see
Letter
that.
In the cinema, do we?
No.
So he must be the guy who reports them dead.
Then. Yes. Yeah. It's again, for some reason as a kid, I always was like, oh, he dies too. But he doesn't. He doesn't. He's walking. Where the hell is he from his house? It looks like he's 5 miles away from his house.
Yeah, he must be on the outskirts of London. See, that's the thing. For this to happen, he must be on the outskirts of London or he's near a park.
Here we go. Now he's going to step in the severed hand and then just that look. Okay.
Old-fashioned rotary phone.
Yeah. Oh, Lord. Kids these days, they don't know how long it took to make a phone call. You had to be very patient, especially if somebody had a lot of nines in their number.
I don't know if it's the camera angle or the lighting, but she looks gorgeous in this scene.
Yeah. Has David? Yeah. Oh my God. Has David persisted in his werewolf fantasies?
I love that she's so proper.
Yeah. Yes, Doctor.
I love that he's Mr. Tweedy in what great. He wears as well. He's
great. He showed up in The Crown recently. And
did he?
He's in a bunch of episodes.
And still working.
Yeah. I was so happy when I saw him. I was like, oh, that's Dr. Hirsch. I was so happy to see him. I was just like, that's great. Because he's got to be like in his 80s now.
He
was great. It was great. That head back there looks like Boris Karloff as the mummy. Which would not surprise me if that was John Landis.
Yeah.
I always think it's a hallmark of a good movie when it's a genre movie like this and you have scenes of characters explaining things and those scenes are interesting. Because a lot of times those movies where the characters are bop, 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 you're just like, get to it. But I love all this. I love his interaction with Alex. I think it's great. It's really involved. I mean, I want to see the werewolf out there killing people. But this is – he's so good in this. John Woodbine is so good in this.
Well, that's what I meant earlier on when I said he's Patrick Stewart. He can carry that scene and you're watching it and you're captivated with it and you're not going, it's exposition. It has to go somewhere.
Yep. It reminds me of the scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark with the government functionaries.
With the top men.
Yeah, I love those guys. I could watch a whole movie of those guys talking to Indy about the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah. And you only have to compare that with the same scene in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which is him and Shia LaBeouf wandering around, and it's a bit dull.
Yeah.
Just the contrast. I love that. London Bridge.
Man, in front of the homeless.
Pan around a bit more. There it is. There's MI6 headquarters from the Bond films.
Oh, really?
Daniel Craig ones, yeah.
Oh, wow. So one of the homeless guys here is Sidney Bromley. He was in a lot of movies. He was in The Neverending Story, Dragon Slayer. He's in one of the Carry On movies, because of course he is. Candle Shoe, the Disney movie Candle Shoe. And look, I like to say that the dog got away. When the dog runs away, the dog, the dog knows there's trouble and just puts it out of there. Yeah.
Tottenham Court Road tube station has not changed.
Oh, is it really? Is this what it looks like now? It
still looks exactly like this. Yeah.
Okay.
Still got those green tiles.
Now, here is Michael Carter as Gerald Bringsley. This is by far, the best kill in the movie. It's the creepiest sequence. I love that how long, Landis teases this out. I love that what he's getting here at this vending machine? Oh, is it cigarettes?
I think it's cigarettes.
Okay.
You don't get that anymore, obviously.
No, certainly not. I love that all of a sudden it seems so benign just getting off the tube and then you're like, he's all by himself. Like, that's really creepy. And then here's the initial...
Oh, it may be gum. Oh, he's got something. It may be just chewing gum.
Because he's about to put it in his mouth and then he stops.
Yeah, he just put it in his mouth, so it may just be chewing gum. But they did used to have cigarette vending machines.
Okay. Is anyone there?
This, Rob, is the most credulity-stretching thing about this film. The London Underground is never empty.
Okay. Oh, really? This would never happen? In the middle of the night kind of thing?
No.
Okay. It's creepy. I shall report this. I love that. Yeah. By the way, this is Michael Carter. He's still working. But for us nerds out there, his claim to fame would be, do you know what other movie I'm about to mention?
Nope.
He was in Return of the Jedi as Bib Fortuna.
Is he?
He's Bib Fortuna. John Wonga Wonga. He's
Bib Fortuna. The advert for See You Next Wednesday.
There you go. Yeah, in every John Landis movie. Yeah, but that's his main credit.
British people listening to this next to him, there's an advert for Minder.
What's that?
That's a British, very popular British television show in the early 80s about Arthur Daly, who was a used car salesman, and his minder, Terry McCann.
Gotcha. There's the poster for A Nonstop Orgy, See You Next Wednesday, which is, of course, every John Landis movie, yes.
I was trying to watch how many of these posters are for West End shows that are still going on.
There's got to be an ad for Coronation Street, right? There's got to be one of them somewhere.
I would have thought there'd be one for Cats. That seems like it's been on forever.
Here we go. He's running, and I love that he just gets disoriented. Like, it's just like, where the hell? What? I don't know where am I going?
That's a good shot down the escalator.
Yeah. As the wolf just wanders
into view. Yeah.
What a stunt, man! That he gets. Here we go. Yeah, we're gonna see him. I miss this so many times that you actually see the wolf at the top of the frame there.
Yeah,
I always miss that. For some reason, I was always looking at Joe. But that stunt is great when he falls onto the escalator and he bangs his head. That looks like that might really hurt. So, yeah, poor Gerald gets it. So now David's waking up in the zoo. Like, okay.
I love all the shots of the animals in the zoo.
I'm just sort of staring at him. Like, how'd you get here?
Yeah.
Oh, man, we actually see his junk there.
Yeah, you do later on as well when he's running through the when he's running to and he steals the coat. I think he takes his hand up a split second too soon. So there you go, full frontal male nudity. The film was ahead of its time.
Okay, so Alex is wondering where he is.
You've got to love a Princess Diana flex that she's got going on in this.
He's wandering around the zoo here, naked. Oh, yeah, there you see him. You see him, he's naked. Yeah, okay. Boy, this could not have been comfortable, right? Because this looks cold.
No. Yeah, and he's leaping over there. With his, with that on display, he's not wearing anything.
Oh, he's running into the old lady. Excuse me. Now, this is on a weekend, I think. I think they established this is on a weekend.
Yeah.
It might, right? So why is this little boy in his school outfit? Wouldn't he be?
That is an exceptionally good question.
Yeah, why is he in his little outfit?
And one probably best not thought about.
Okay. This is this kid's only credit, by the way. He was never in any other movies. I should mention the old lady that he ran into was Elizabeth Bradley. She was in Coronation Street. Again, like probably a lot of British actors were. Yeah. A lot of other British television. And then we're
going Corrie or EastEnders. They're living in one of them.
Thank you. And then we're going to run into this little kid's mom. That's Leslie. Here we go. And he's going to run by. Bang. And there he grabs the coat. Here goes the mom. This is Leslie Ward. She only has two credits, Hanover Street with Harrison Ford and this movie.
All right.
That's it. I even love this scene where he gets the new manor monster from the Daily Mirror. There you go. But I just even love the way he does this. I love when the news vendor is like, 12 pence, sir. And I just love the way Woodfine's like, what? Oh, yeah, sorry. Like, he realizes, I've been reading the paper a little too long.
Yeah, not
pay for it. Yeah, it's great. Just that is great. The balloons.
I love the pan across.
This is great. The news vendor is George Hildson, who passed away right after this. He was in The Fiendish Plot of Dr. Fu Manchu. Not a great movie, but I saw it as a kid. And Britannia Hospital, which I have seen. And then he passed away just a couple years ago, like 1983. So a lot of weather we've been having.
Love that line. A lot of weather we've been having.
So
I love an American trying to do British small talk.
How does he get on this bus? He doesn't have any money. I mean, maybe there's money in the coat.
Maybe he found some money in the pocket of the coat.
Yeah.
That's what I assumed.
What was she doing? She's sitting on the... What is she... Oh, she's having tea, of course.
Yeah, she's having a cup of tea, yeah.
Of course. Alex, you won't believe it. You won't believe this.
And see, I love that they're still playing this as it's very lighthearted. He's still not 100% buying into the fact that he just killed three people.
Mm-hmm. Six people.
Is it six?
He's killed the couple. He's killed Gerald, and then the three hobos. So he's killed.
Yes, yeah, he killed the three guys.
Yeah, he's really went on quite the rampage.
He's been quite busy last night.
No, she's still, she's still attracted to him. So okay, all right, she's just happy he's back.
I like that he didn't just buy one pair, but he's bought them all.
It's great. Bought every newspaper he could get his hands on.
Yeah.
I love the zoo.
How many clothes did he bring with him?
Yeah, I know. It's a lot of clothes. Bring David straight away. I love. He's so good. Yeah, he's such a good doctor. He's such a good doctor. He's like, I really, because he knows this poor kid is really in trouble. I expect you shortly. This is great. Just great. Again, it's interesting why this is. I would love to know why it wasn't like a bigger name. John Woodvine was not a name. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm happy it's John Woodvine, but I could see an American studio, Universal, saying, "Can you get Anthony Hopkins? Can you get John Hurt? Can you get somebody with a little bit of a name recognition?" But no, he's just great.
Yeah, he's brilliant. He's absolutely fantastic in it, isn't he?
So now he's got they're having fun. He's feeling quite randy, obviously.
Frisky.
And then we've got the taxi driver played by Alan Ford.
This is the guy. This is the one I was on about earlier on. He's got this one scene in it. Alan Ford's career is magnificent. Recently in the horror film Cockneys versus Zombies. And he's practically unrecognizable because obviously you only see the back of his head most of the time. I only recognize him because of his voice.
Okay. He was in Toast of London with Matt Berry, which is a show I love. I love that show.
I love Toast of London. I love it when he's living with Peter Davison.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Absolutely brilliant Toast of London.
He was also in Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. Yeah, he was in Snatch. Barrels. Obviously, he's Guy Ritchie. Yeah.
One of Guy Ritchie's regular players.
The Long Good Friday he was in with Bob Hoskins. That's a great movie. So, he said. Quite an amazing. He's got a couple of hundred credits. Good for him. That's great.
He's in a lot of stuff, Alan Ford. He does a lot of voiceover work as well, for adverts and stuff.
Oh, okay. I love this.
But if this is still the weekend, that little kid there was in a school uniform.
Okay. I love this cop. It's just like,
I love the cops. I just go away, will you?
He doesn't want to do any of this.
I can't be bothered.
By the way, the actor playing the cop, Peter Ellis, was also in The Crown. Right. Playing different characters. He's been in a couple different episodes, but here he's trying to offend. I love these, the line about.
I love this. Churchill was a Frenchman.
I'm gonna haul you in. He's, that's what I want you to do, you moron. Like, now, I mean, you know, obviously David isn't pushing this as far as he could. He could have decked the cop.
Yeah, he could have punched
and that would have got him thrown in jail. I mean, he doesn't try really hard. He just kind of curses. I mean, if you really wanted to get arrested, you can get arrested. I mean, come on.
It's clearly as well, it's clearly off and on raining. If you look at David's hair, it goes from being wet to dry to wet again, but it's particularly noticeable on Jenny Agutter.
Oh, right. Yeah, her hair's real. Yes, her hair is flopped down.
And then it starts having all that moisture. There you go.
Yep.
The hair is a lot wetter, though, than it was just in the minute, the dialogue before. And now it's dry again.
He says he loves her.
It must have started raining while they were filming one side of the conversation.
Yep. It's a big moment, though. He tells her he loves her.
Yeah.
Like, that's a huge... And he runs away.
It's the realization that he is actually... he was right. He's actually killing people. Jack was right when he was telling him all that.
Yep. There we go. The cops are... I love that the second cop says, before nightfall. Like, he's kind of taking it seriously. The inspector guy clearly just thinks this is all bunk. But I love that the second cop is a clown, at least in the eyes of the other guy, but he's actually right. He's
actually trying to do his job properly.
Yep.
And the inspector guy's just coursed into retirement.
Yeah. Then there's this little physical gag here where he tries to reassure them, we will find him. And he turns and then the doors shut on his face. So I was like, okay. I know that some people found this stuff to be, you know, a little discordant as to why they had these kind of jokes in there, but it doesn't. I like it.
I think it's funny.
Yeah.
It goes into that whole thing. Life doesn't stop being funny when it's serious.
Yeah. Now this is a nice scene.
Yeah. I love
David,
all this.
David calling home. You have to figure Skull. That this is.
Advert for Skull.
What is that?
Skull beer.
Oh, okay. I've never heard of that.
It's a very, very old advert. It was very, very funny. The advert was Skull, 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 Skull. And somebody says, why are you not joining our drinking song? And the other guy says, I don't know the words.
Okay.
That was the advert. Skull, 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 Skull.
Is that what the Monty Python was parodying? When they did the spam thing? The spam?
No, it was well after the Skull advert. It was well after that. They may have got the idea from Python.
Gotcha.
All these red telephone boxes that don't really exist anymore.
I love this scene. This is great. You get the sense that David knows he's going to die.
Yeah.
And he's trying to say goodbye to his family. He mentions Max. You have to assume that that's John Landis inserting the name of his own problematic son, let's say.
Oh, God, yeah.
to be polite about it.
Twig that.
Yeah, but this is I like this scene. Apparently, I was looking at the trivia, and they said that like when this film got remastered for one of the releases, there was some sort of problem, and the scene got cut, which is ridiculous because this is a big moment. You know, he tries to kill himself here, and he can't bring himself to do it, which is understandable. I mean, it's pretty hard to do it with that little knife.
Yeah,
that's going to take a while to try and do it. But I just think that's really sweet where he clearly knows he's going to die and he's trying to say goodbye to his family. And he has to have this kind of boring conversation with his little sister about, you know, left her alone when you're here. This is great. I love that there's Jack standing there at the movie theater. I love that he just points. It's creepy. And I don't know, I just love it. I love that it's so kind of subtle. He's just, all right, come on.
Oh, and here's the cinema.
There we go. We're showing. See you next Wednesday, as was promised. Christina Hargreaves is the ticket lady. Who's the? She looks bored with her job, as you might imagine, being a ticket taker in a porn theater.
And I looked this up as well. She says it's £2.80, which is about a 10 quid nowadays, which is a decent price for a ticket theater in London.
Okay. She passed away in 1985. She died very young. She was in her last movie was in 1984, the adaptation of 1984.
Oh, all right. With John Hurt.
John Hurt. Yep. I love this. Great movie. I love this porn movie that was shot by John Landis. This was all shot by John Landis.
The woman in this, Brenda Bristles, has a very famous son in Britain.
Oh, who's that?
The woman, her son is Tyler Drew Honey, who starred in a number of sitcoms.
Oh, okay.
Outnumbered being the most popular one. But he made a documentary about what it's like to grow up with parents that are porn stars.
Oh, so she was, she was a real porn star.
Porn star, yeah. Oh. And his dad is as well.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
His dad's a porn star as well.
He
made a film. He made a documentary on BBC Three about the difficulties of growing up with that.
Wow.
But as far as he was concerned, it was mum and dad.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, she certainly got the build of a porn star.
I mean, I love Lord. Her porn star name is Brenda Bristles.
Some of her movies, I'm looking at her credits here on IMDb. I mean, she was in the Lair of the White Worm, real movie. But she was in movies with titles called like Thunder Boobs and Lesbian Lovers 2. So there you go.
The animatronic on Jackie is brilliant.
Oh, man. Now, what I had read here that they had let Griffin Dunn operate the puppet.
Oh, right.
Like, he's behind. Here we go. Now he's meeting here. He's meeting all of his victims.
Yeah.
This is great. This Michael Carter's read on this whole bit is
yes. He's great. Just pissed off, isn't he?
He is so focused, and he points at him. I love this. Most unpleasant. He's so... he's your good friend. I am the victim of your lunar carnivorous activities. The way he spits it out is great.
Yeah, he's not happy about it. Jack's kind of like, well, you know, you didn't actually kill me. Shit happens.
Yeah. But Kelly and I say that to each other all the time. We're always talking about our lunar carnivorous activities. He's great. He's great in this. Again, it's so, you know, I mean, if you're a really good actor, you can make a lot with a small part.
Yep.
You know, I love the point. This point, I love that when the hand is caked in blood and he's pointing at him, you must die. Like, it's great. I love this couple. Look how happy they are.
I love that the couple are still happy. Yeah.
Yeah. Hello. The homeless guys, they're not happy. They're mad about all this. Could say we're pleased to meet you, Mr. Kessler. But apparently, yes. I love her suggestions of how he can die. Why are you doing this to me? But yeah, apparently Griffin Dunn is behind the seat here operating the puppet. He said so he could match it to his performance. They allowed him to do that, which is that's pretty
really cool.
Isn't
it?
Yeah. I mean, how would he even know how to do that exactly? I mean, I'm guessing he has a monitor. And he's watching what he's doing because, I mean, you're behind the puppet. You're doing the opposite. You're doing the reverse of what you think you're doing.
Hmm.
But I love this. A car crash. She's so chipper. I love the... Yeah. Pull the trigger. The blood's on her teeth. She looks horrible. I love the bit about, do I need a silver bullet? Oh, come on. Like, making fun of him. Like, he's like... I mean, you know, the guy's only seen werewolf movies. What else does he think?
Yeah. I mean, you're at the point now where you really are questioning that he must be seeing something, mustn't he?
Yeah.
Because otherwise he doesn't know that he's killed these people.
Yep. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he doesn't know any of these people. By the way, this movie only has 11 more minutes left. This movie just blazes by. I mean, I think if they made this today... It would be 2 hours, and it would be uninterminable because there'd be a half hour of just, oh, God, you know, this movie is really well put together. Speaking of which, I will get over very briefly. There was, of course, a sequel to this movie, which is just awful.
I've never been able to sit through it.
It is awful, and I love Julie Delpy. She is the star of my favorite movie of all time, and it is just terrible. I mean, it's the effects are terrible. The story is ludicrous. It's not scary, it's not funny, and it has a very tangential connection to this film. It talks about there's this history of vampires. Apparently there was supposed to be a more explicit connection and they edited that out. I don't know why. It's one of the things, why they even bother? Why even bother make that movie?
Especially seeing as you have got the potential for a sequel.
Yes.
Right there at the end of the movie.
Yes.
So, you know, yeah, I mean, it stands on its own.
Alex is pregnant. There you go. Alex
be pregnant. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. By the way,
do the Fly 2 before the Fly 2.
There you go. That, well, yeah, do the Fly 2, but better. But the actor playing the theater usher is Ken Sicklin. He was in Flash Gordon, as well as some other British TV, but that's his other major credit. He did this right back-to-back with American Werewolf in London was Flash Gordon. The gore here is amazing. Like the pile of goo that the werewolf is... By the way, what theater has a front entrance by the screen? I've never seen that before. That you come in by the screen. That's no Actually, movie theater that, I've ever that attended.
That used to be the exit in old theaters, yeah. You would go down to the front and you would go through the emergency exits at the side of the screen and that's how you would leave.
Well, right, we have those, but you can't. Right, but you can't come in that way, though, at least in America.
Oh, no, you could only leave that way. You couldn't go in.
A pile of goo there. Look at that.
And this is where it really kicks up the gore.
Yeah, this is crazy. This whole scene is insane. Of just, I love all these people are milling around. Like, get the hell out of there! What are you talking about? Why? The cops are telling them, "Get out!" And they're all like, they're all just look. They're all rushing to get over.
Yeah,
crazy.
To see what's going on?
Now, apparently, Landis had to shoot this in like 3 2-minute bursts for how long they would close Piccadilly Circus or something like. He shot it 3 times and they had to get it, you know, bing, bang, boom, and then do it again and do it again. And then that was it.
Right.
And shoot it in the middle of the night. Yeah. Shoot it at like 3 a.m.
Yeah. And it's in the theater district. So it will have been quite busy at this time of night. Yeah.
Here's the inspector. He's about to get it. And then whammo in the chomp. And there goes the head. Absolutely great. I love that.
Because it's amazing how gory this last bit gets, isn't it?
The mayhem, but boy, John Landis loves cars smashing into other things.
Yes, he's just, it does.
Here we go. The body gets run over. People get pinned. Look at this. Oh my lord! Look at that.
Yeah, it all goes a bit Blues Brothers towards the end. It really does.
If somebody get look at that. Oh, they get shot through the glass. Somebody goes through the windshield. These all count as werewolf kills, I would say.
Yeah,
they all count. So
how many werewolves are going to be left at the end of this as well?
Seriously, right? Yeah.
That don't die.
Yep.
Obviously, the police inspector loses his head, but some of them...
There's the scene with Doctor. You want to point out the little thing there?
Yeah, what's brilliant about watching this last time, this brief scene here, John Woodvine has a pencil mustache.
You never noticed
that. Which he does not have in any other scene in the film. And the only thing, as soon as I saw that last night, I messaged Rob and said, have you ever noticed that? Because I've never spotted it.
Yep, never seen it.
And the only thing I could think of was it was a pickup shot, and Landis may have felt, we need to explain how Alex and Dr. Hirsch end up here.
Yep. And right, by that point, John Woodvine had grown a mustache and maybe couldn't get rid of it, although you would think, you know, maybe he was in the middle of
shooting.
Well,
if it was for a role, it may have been a Henry Cavill deal.
Yeah, right.
I mean, if they've pulled him in off another shoot,
said
we need to insert this film, and they shoot him in profile, so you can't really tell.
And he's got pancake makeup on. But when you said it to me, I was like, what? And then I looked, yep, there it is. He's got a little John Waters mustache.
A little John Waters mustache,
And now it's gone now. He's back in the
car. So he does I looked carefully. He never has it at any other point in the film.
It makes total sense. We don't know, but that makes total sense that they, Landis, they watch the movie and they realize, well, how do they know to get here? Oh, we got to shoot a single of them just saying, hey, there's news of a mad dog in the.
That when it must be annoying as an actor that you're pulled back in to her and makeup and all that stuff for that one, 15 second scene of that?
Yep. Yep. Now they're all here. They've cornered. Cornered the wolf in the alley.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. Now, I mean, the physics of this don't make any sense because Alex is standing between the cops and the wolf, and somehow they shoot past her.
Yeah, from that distance. Look how far away they were.
Yeah, I mean, they're a good half mile away, but they're sharpshooters, I'm going to say, and the wolf is crouched down, so they aimed down low, and they shot past her legs, I'll say that. You know, let's just, that's what we're...
And let's give all the credit in the world to John Baker that they do some acting with that puppet's eyes.
Yep.
The close-up of the werewolf's eyes. They've got some acting going on there.
Yep. Now, I mean, there is the line about that David believes that a werewolf can be cured by someone that loves him. I always figure that that's what they're hinting at, that there's a moment where she could cure him of this, where he softens, because as we're going to see, the eyes soften. And then, of course, he reverts to werewolf form. And that's going right. It's going to be right after this moment. He's going to soften just a little. She says, I love you. And then he's going to there. He softens. The snout goes down. And then he up. Oh, there you go. And then bango. Yep. They shoot him. And John Woodvine comes running again. He's such a good doctor. He's just like, yep, man, he cares so much about this.
I like that they didn't do that, though. I like that they maintained the mythology that the werewolf is a werewolf and he doesn't give a toss about your human emotions.
Yeah.
And I think it makes the ending work so much better.
And then she's crying there. And then we're going to get...
again, it's Agatha who sells it.
Yep. Yeah, she's just completely crushed. And we get one last chance of Dr. Hirsch and then one more shot of David. And then back to blah, 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 blah. Now, what do you think of that cut? Of that very serious, sad ending with this goofy song at the end. Do you think it kind of craps on it a little? I go back and forth.
I don't know. I don't think it does, because it's been the tone of the film all the way through it. Mm. They'll undercut something with a joke, but the horror is played for serious. And I kind of like that they do that, because it just snaps you right out of it, because you're very, well, that's it?
Yeah, right.
Because you're expecting an epilogue, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you don't get it. But you've got the setup there for a sequel. She could be pregnant. Any number of the people that he scratched or attacked don't have to be dead.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, he cut some heads off, but I mean, he didn't kill everybody.
No. Nope.
So yeah, there's got to be at least a couple people that are going to wake up turning into werewolves later. Yeah. You could have followed this any other way, and instead they made. Apparently, Landis wrote a treatment, and they ditched it, and they ditched, and they went for what they made, which is just an absolute waste of time. So don't even worry about
it. Don't even bother. But Armstrong was one of the stuntmen. Harrison Ford's stunt double.
Oh, is that who that is? Okay. Yeah.
Vic Armstrong was Harrison Ford's main stunt double. Most of Temple of Doom is Vic Armstrong.
Okay.
True, because Harrison Ford had to have an operation.
Wow. A costume designed by Deborah Noodleman. That is John Landis's wife. The stunt gaffer, Alf Joint. The reason I know that name, he plays Lee Remick in The Omen when she falls out the window of the hospital. Yeah, that's Alf Joint. And the reason I even know that is from the audio commentary between Richard Donner, my good friend, the late great Richard Donner, and the editor, Stuart Baird, because they talk about that he kept criticizing Alf Joint for moving his arms too much. Because, of course, he was playing a woman. And he was like, you know, Alfie, can you not move your arm so much? Because every time he did the fall, and he does an imitation of Alfie Joint going, Stuart, I'm trying to control my fall as best I can. I just love that idea of imitating this Alfie Joint. Alfie, just I see that name. So, yeah, I mean, it's this movie. I've seen it hundreds of times at this point. We put it on at night to go to sleep. Because we like to have some movie playing in the background as we fall asleep. It just works so well. It works as a comedy. It works as horror. The performances are all marvelous. I mean, this is the kind of movie that I wish you could see 10 minutes later, because now everybody knows that werewolves are real.
Yeah.
All the cops, you can't ignore it. There is no way that anyone could say anything other than there are werewolves now, because there was a wolf there. We shot the wolf and now it's a guy.
No, it wasn't. It was a rabid dog.
A rabid dog.
And that's what the papers will report.
There you go.
And I love that it's dedicated to Lady Diana and the Prince of Wales.
A little goof on Lady Diana and His Royal Highness.
Yeah.
Oh, marvelous. Just a great movie. And it said the movie was a big success. And, you know, Landis went on to some other great films and some infamy, unfortunately. But this was when he was still, you know, burning on all thrusters. And like I said, it's just a... It really is the kind of the classic one for me, one for them, even though this is a very commercial movie, but it was something he wanted to make that nobody wanted to make, and he had the clout to get it made, and he made it the way he wanted to get it made, and it ended up turning out really great. It's just a marvelously... the card at the end, when in Hollywood, visit Universal Studios, ask for Babs, which is the joke.
I wonder if that still works.
It does not. I looked that up. They stopped it, but they only stopped it about 10 years ago.
Right.
And yeah, Animal House is a 40-year-old movie. So I love that Universal honored that for several decades after the movie was gone. So it's great. Yeah. It's just an absolutely marvelous movie. So, wow. I mean, again, that went by so fast.
That sailed by, didn't it? And we've watched it twice in 2 days, in less than 24 hours. Yeah,
absolutely marvelous. So, well, I guess we're wrapping up here. Is there anything you want to say about this movie before we sign off, Andy?
I was very surprised at how well it held up, honestly. I mean, I've watched it quite a lot of times, obviously, over the year, and I dug the DVD out yesterday so I could watch it properly. And I was quite impressed by how well the special effects still hold up, and the performances, and the comedy's still funny, and the gory's still gory.
Yep. It won an Oscar.
Did it?
It won the first Best Makeup Oscar for Rick Baker. That award had never been given out before. For that category, and then they created it for this, which is, again, it deserves it, because it's a great movie.
Yeah,
I remembered reading at the time, or later on, like, Roger Ebert panned it, and I liked reading Roger Ebert, but I couldn't understand what he was talking about. He was like, oh, it's not scary, it's not funny, and I was like, what is he talking about? And
film was he watching?
Yeah, what film was he watching? It was just terrific. And but the fact that they did the radio version in 1990 and bothered to get Jenny Agutter and John Woodvine, tells you it's got quite the legacy that they bothered to get those actors. And I'm so happy that, like, Woodvine did it and Jenny Agutter did it. And, like, they still kind of are, like, you know, proud of their association with the movie. And, man, I mean, if I ever went to a horror con and John Woodvine was there, I would make the effort to go see him, because I would love to, you know, meet him. It would be great. I mean, obviously I'd love to meet Jenny Agutter, but I'd probably really embarrass myself. But yeah, it's just a marvelous movie. It's something I watch all the time, and I thought it was a perfect thing to do for Halloween.
Celebrate Halloween.
Yeah, yeah. Halloween.
And the music's brilliant as well. We've not mentioned that the music throughout the entire film is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
When I was on Ryan's show, I picked a track from this film.
Oh, that's right. That's right. You did. Yeah. The needle drops are great. And then the Elbert Bernstein score is great. I said, it works. It works from Sin to Stern. It's just really, really marvelous movie. And they've been rumors that there's going to be a remake. But that was when, again, it was attached to Max Landis, and I don't think that's going to happen anymore. Even if Max Landis doesn't do it and somebody else does it, don't bother with it. Yeah, you don't need to remake this. So, well, Andy, thank you so much for joining me, man. I really appreciate it. I was so dying to do this, and I didn't know if anybody was a big enough fan like me to do it. So thank you so much for coming on and talking this movie with me.
No, it was a pleasure. It's the first time you and I have done this solo.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, this is absolutely great. So, why don't you tell?
That was a lot of fun. I enjoyed
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. So, why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
The Palace of Glittering Delights continues to churn on. My Halloween episode is out as well. I will be looking at The Vampire, an episode of Starsky and Hutch. Yes, Starsky and Hutch did a vampire episode.
I did not know that.
I am not. What's his name? Oh, John Saxon was the vampire.
This is all news to me.
This is all new news to you. That's on twotruefreaks.com. I love doing Palace. I do the Overlook Dark Knight with Michael Bailey, where we talk about Batman stories that we think don't get the attention they deserve, because there's a lot of them, and that's fun. And have we started dropping Toon Trek, where we're looking at the animated Star Trek shows yet? I don't know. But if they have, that's on. And I'm on Facebook and Twitter and all of that stuff. Come and say hi. And it was a pleasure and a privilege. Because it was watching them. It's a bit out of my wheelhouse as well, from what I normally talk about. So that was fun.
Yeah. Oh, I said, I love doing the audio commentaries. They're more kind of stressful, because they, you know, you do them all in one go. You can't really edit, because I want people to, if you're watching the movie. But at the same time, it's like, when it's a movie you love, it's like it's my way of, like, doing a tribute. It's like, I love this movie so much, I'm willing to talk for 97 minutes over it, because I just love it.
We didn't have a lot of silence, though, did we?
No, like I said, I knew this was something that I keep finding new things in, new little moments, aside from, like, the mustache you're talking about, but, like, just little bits, even though, again, this movie's not long and I've seen it so many times, I still find little details, and it holds up so I knew I just had so much to say. So I just thought it was the perfect way to celebrate Halloween. So, okay, everybody. So thanks so much for listening. You can find back episodes of the show on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the Film and Water Podcast on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking movies over on Twitter at Film and Water Pod. You can listen to my other movie shows, Fade Out and Superman 3 Movie Minute. And then there's also Citizen Kane Minute, which is just wrapped up. And then finally, if you want to support the Find Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name-checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to my pal Corey Musa for his support of the Film and Water Podcast. So that is going to do it. happy Halloween, everybody. Have fun. Go get some candy. Go watch American Werewolf in London. And there'll be some more episodes coming pretty soon. But until then, that's a wrap.
You're not real.
Oh, don't be a putz, David.